Good morning, listeners. Welcome to another edition of Growing Pains, the only podcast dedicated to economic development in Atlantic Canada. Matt George is off getting married, so I'm happy to say that Herb Emery has agreed to come back and join us again this week. Matt will be back probably next week if all goes well. Dr. Emery, welcome and good morning.
Good morning.
So glad to have you back. One of the things about you that's very interesting is you are writing this weekly column for Brunswick News. And so there's always fodder to discuss. And of course, this week you, I think, wrote something quite worthy of our conversation this morning. So you started by talking about this book that you read to, they're not even economists, right? One's a psychologist. What are they? What's
diversity? They're both psychologists.
Yeah.
And they're credited with pioneering behavioral economics and behavioral psychology with decision analysis.
Right. Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. So tell us a little bit about The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds, which is the book, but also their main thesis.
So the book was interesting to me, particularly when we were coming out of the Turning Point series. And as you know, I was sort of gobsmacked by some of the responses about growth being unnecessary and everything's fine. And you've been writing some great blog posts on the indifference of New Brunswickers to things like maritime iron. And then you helped me out with that list of capital projects that haven't gone ahead for some time. And so if you look at New Brunswick objectively from the outside, the place looks like a basket case fiscally. But everyone just keeps spending and saying the government, federal government will just give us more. So to an outsider, it seems like there's sort of a mass delusion going on about what reality looks like. So when I'd stumbled on this book on a remainder pile in chapters, I was aware of it because I'd heard an interview with Michael Lewis, the author, talking about the book. I picked it up, and what was interesting to me is I'd worked a lot with Kahneman Tversky's work on decision-making under uncertainty from an academic perspective, but the book did a good job of putting it in terms of everyday life. And one of the things that started to ring like a loud bell was it starts to explain the psychology behind why New Brunswickers aren't that interested in statistical evidence like I provide and you provide, why stories are so influential for making policy change go ahead, why everything here feels like a giant communication strategy as opposed to an evidence-based exercise. And so at the end of the day, it turns out if we really take human behavior seriously, it's we have to accept there's a certain degree of super rationality that comes in with our perspective on the world, and it's not how most people operate. So you get into these other notions that have challenged economics and behavior, like bounded rationality. If I can't determine what is going to happen with everything, I have ways of simplifying my life to make quicker decisions. And in the case of Kahneman Tversky, it comes down to there's a strong belief that what you have now, the status quo, is going to be there with certainty. And so it's something that you have to be convinced is worth giving up for something better. And so whenever somebody comes in and says, we need to change, you're really saying there's a gamble. You might do better, you might do worse, but you may need to make a choice. And so this gets into problems like regret. If I choose to take a gamble and I lose, I feel bad. But if I don't take the gamble and still wind up with a certain loss, I don't feel as bad because it's not my fault. I didn't make the decision. So to me, I think there's a lot of profound insights that Lewis's book explaining Kahneman Tversky's work would have for a lay audience, the general readers, for understanding just why we have political leaders who prefer indecision to taking action. Things as simple as that.
Yeah, so I guess part of the challenge with us is the difference between the current state and the future, potential future state. So the, if you're sick currently, have a bad headache or some sort of nausea or whatever, you're very sick. You don't need somebody to come in and say, hey, you're sick. You know, like, let me explain to you why you're sick. But if you think they're going to get sick tomorrow because of the things they're doing today, and they can't readily see it, then I think that's really what we're talking about here. So what that means in an academic, or excuse me, in an economic setting, is that things are pretty good in New Brunswick right now. right? The unemployment rate is low. I mean, again, COVID-19, but just in general, lots of people are pretty economically stable. The share of the population below the poverty line is very, very low relative to historical norms. Lots of people are on retirement income. Lots of people are heading toward retirement. So I'd say things are pretty comfortable right now in New Brunswick. So then Herb comes along and says, well, wait a minute, look at these fundamental issues. So I guess my question for you is, A, do you think things are actually bad right now? And let's move that off of COVID-19, let's just say in general, in New Brunswick. Or are you suggesting that they're going to be more problematic 5 or 10 years out? Or are you just saying number three or option three, are you saying that it's just, we're just kind of suboptimal here? I guess I'm rambling, but I'd like to know what you're actually saying.
I would too. So let's take a different position, which is more Kahneman Tversky's, which is you and I are no better at predicting the future than anyone else. But we have this gloomy, pessimistic view based on data where we go out and we look at what we believe are objective indicators that tell us something about the future. And so we get nervous because we have beliefs like people will not continue to lend us money forever if we can't figure out how to pay them back. And a lot of people don't believe that anymore. They just believe the federal government can print money infinitely, and so debt isn't real. So we're coming up with, we now have competing stories. You and I have one prediction where we say it's based in data, it's based on logic, it's based on theory. And someone else comes along and says, but I have another theory which explains why those guys are wrong and they don't understand the new economics. And so we don't know who's right. It's possible that the other side is correct, that debt really is a figment of our imaginations and we don't need to worry about it. It really comes down to there's some magic alchemy going on that I just don't have the imagination to see, which is another theme of Kahneman Tversky, is that if you can't explain to people how this works, then their imagination doesn't make it real for them. So let's get back a bit when you said we're all comfortable. It's a great story, but it misses that the people who are here are comfortable. The people who have left went somewhere else because they were not comfortable, and the people who aren't coming here believe they're more comfortable somewhere else. So now you have this time bomb that you and I have talked about fiscally, and it's not because of aging people, it's because of how we finance our healthcare and finance our support programs. But we do have this problem that we have to collect a lot of tax to pay for what we promised. So you and I look at it and we say, we think there's a problem. And someone else comes along and says, no, it's fine, we're all comfortable today. So they don't see the crisis or the unfunded liability, as it's called in the future, as a real cost. So then we come back and they say, but if we can grow the population and we can grow the economy, which is going to take some changes in how we do things, we're going to have to not be so insular in how we do things. We need to be more welcoming. We need to compete more. We're not going to be comfortable anymore. We can't just rely on the federal government to continue to pay for everything. We then run into this story that you and I have both encountered, which no one ever challenges, which is this idea under the inequality agenda of the last 20, 30 years, which is more Piketty's work and even Karl Marx, which is growth is not shared in a capitalist economy. So there's a view that even if we do grow this economy, it's just going to make a small number of faceless people, or even better, the stereotypes, big companies, McCain and Irving will get rich and no one else will. So what's the point? And so the interesting part of it is that then you'll point out, and Don Mills points out, there's a wage gap. Other places that have had investment and grown more have higher incomes, they have higher wages, they have lower taxes. And the response to that is, well, that's not here, or we're fine. So again, statistics don't change anyone's view because we have stories that we have to deal with, which is why do people believe that the benefits of growth aren't shared? And your recent column about Rip Van Winkle and is this the same economy as the 1970s is absolutely hilarious. If you take yourself today, go back to when your father was your same age, ask yourself, would you rather be in his shoes or your shoes? And I've had that question posed to kids in my classes, and they can't even picture how their parents were living, and they don't remember how long this affordability of housing crisis. I find hilarious that people in their mid-20s are concerned they can't afford a home. Go back to the 1990s before the federal government did all the big changes to home buyers acts. There was a belief none of us would ever own a home. We couldn't get jobs. We had no access to credit. There was no stock of housing that was affordable. And all that's changed. And now we're sitting here going, boy, I wish I were back in the 1970s.
But you have to admit that those great big Chryslers, you know, those huge cars with the trunks that are actually bigger than the full cars today, that was kind of interesting.
Well, they were. I had some great ones back in the day, including a Pinto with mismatched doors. Like, there's just no crappy cars on the road today like there used to be. And again, you can actually count on getting to your destination today, whereas in the 1970s, when we went on a road trip, we weren't sure if we were getting there without two or three breakdowns. So,
yeah, I mean, the quality, but even the quality of the transportation infrastructure is one of the things I talked about. I mean, when I was young, there was almost no four-lane highways in New Brunswick, and now all of the major cities are connected, and now they're going to connect Miramichi. So there's massive improvements. I'm going to come back to that. But I did want to say we will do a podcast in the future about modern monetary theory, this idea that you can just spend infinitely because you control, you know, the currency and money supply as a national government, or you can basically just, you know, it's almost like that scene in Casablanca. It's a little game. They do the bill and I tear up the bill.
Yeah.
It's basically the same thing here, right? We just issue our own bonds and then we don't pay ourselves back.
That's our hope.
Yeah, so we can talk about that. I'm skeptical of that, and I know you are, and I think a lot of economists are skeptical of that. That eventually there's inflation challenges, and there's other challenges associated with that. But I did want to come back to this issue of is it as bad as it is? Is it as bad here as maybe some people think? So there was an article in The Economist this week that suggested if you look at GDP per capita and you compare, say, London to the hinterland in the UK, there's a 4 to 5 times spread. So in other words, the GDP in London is 4 to 5 times higher per capita than it is in the hinterland. If you look at Canada, the spread is only about 2 to 1. So Alberta's GDP per capita is about twice as high as New Brunswick. I find that high, you know, that because that means the economy is twice the size adjusted for population in Alberta. So that's huge in terms of tax implications and income implications and wealth implications and everything else. And also the reliance on oil and gas, but that's something we've talked about before. But at the end of the day, if it's 4 to 5 times in the UK, if it's 20 times in Brazil, so the GDP per capita in the smallest states and the weakest states in Brazil, compared to Sao Paulo. Sao Paulo is 20 times larger, even on a per capita basis. So is it really that bad here? I mean, we've had federal transfers. We've had fiscal transfers since the 50s. We've had a lot of mechanisms to try and keep that economic level fairly consistent. And I would argue, even if you look at the U.S., if you compare the difference between, say, Louisiana and, I don't know, California, I suspect the difference is maybe even more than 2 to 1. So is it really that bad here comparatively? That's the question.
So it's a really interesting comparison you brought up, because the first thing we have to recognize is Canada is one of the highest income countries by per capita GDP. We sort of trail places like the US, or I think once in a while you get a Norway in there. Again, a lot of the oil states, Switzerland's usually up there. So now you bring up the more interesting point, because the fixation of the last 20 years has been on the spread, not the level. So for most economists, we say if the average level of material well-being is higher, you're doing better. So Canada, just by on its level, is a success story. When you get into how little inequality we have compared to other countries, we can point to things like we have a lot of redistributive policies like federal transfers. Equalization gets picked on, but it's far more pervasive than that. I have colleagues in the West who have done all the accounting for, if you take account of where the federal government collects all their taxes from, all the different sources and where they do all their spending, including equalization, you can look at these net fiscal flows and they're massive. So myth number one about things like the energy economy, that the benefits aren't shared, is laughable when you compare the spread in incomes between Alberta versus New Brunswick compared to some of these other countries you've talked about. We are redistributing the gains through the tax system. Maybe not as much as people want, but that's okay, I guess. The other thing we have to pay attention to is places like London, which have incredible wealth. They don't have a high per capita GDP in the UK, but they do have a financial sector. And over the last 10, 15 years, it's really been the finance and real estate and insurance type businesses that have driven a lot of wealth creation. And a lot of that's been globally concentrated. So not having a major financial center other than Toronto may explain why we don't have the same inequality as, say, a New York or a London. The second piece with Brazil, the first thing we should think about is, where's our poverty? So we've done a really good job about getting a lot of poverty down, especially seniors. We're stubbornly stuck at 12% in the rest of the population, but we don't have slums to the same degree as, say, Brazil does. We don't have the lack of education systems for lower income individuals in those countries. So from a lot of this, again, you have to go back and say, our education system has been a major benefit to all Canadians who are capable of accessing it. Again, we can get into the social determinants of health and things like that about why low-income households aren't benefiting to the same degree. And that's, again, a topic for another day, which is why we should be terrified about the lockdown and COVID and the staged phase back to schooling. We're going to see probably greater disparities being created because the lower socioeconomic status kids tend to fall behind more when school's not in. So with a lot of these things, it's interesting to think about that our story is we're still fixated on the middle class agenda in Canada. We're worried about people in the middle. And the reality is we don't have anywhere near the inequality problems of other places that don't seem as worried about it.
Yeah, that's a message that I think is missing. And I think that because it's driven by politics, right? If you say the middle class, then just about everybody puts up their hand and says, that's me. And so it's politically salient to talk about helping the middle class. But I agree with you that the issues aren't nearly as problematic here as they are in some other countries. I do find this United Kingdom example interesting because the whole economic development strategy of the government over there is called leveling up. And they're actually, you know, they've determined that they're one of their goals is to try and bring that GDP per capita up to maybe not par, but to try and get it away from that 4-5 spread. And you're right, it's just gotten worse in recent years because of London and its role as a global financial center. But the other thing that's interesting is because there's so many people in those poorer regions of the UK, again, not nearly as many as London, but enough so that the political calculus is that Boris Johnson and his government have decided that leveling up is going to be electorally beneficial. I suspect the federal government in Canada, why, first of all, maybe we don't need to level up as much, but even if a national government said our strategy is to level up, in other words, to bring the poorer provinces up, there'd be no political calculus to do that because where are the votes, right? I mean, there's more people in Mississauga than there are in all of New Brunswick.
So the other thing to remember, there's no votes in provinces for the federal government. There's votes in people living in provinces. So if you look at what this government that's been in power now since 2015 does, it doesn't do things to level up provinces. It's doing things to help the middle class across the country. So a lot of their policies are transfers to individuals, not traditional economic development through a provincial agency. And that's where a lot of the tension is starting to come in because the historic federal agencies and strategies was actually maintaining a lot of employment in this region. And so we start to get nervous when ECOA is no longer central because we have CERB and benefits that go directly to individuals to buy allegiance.
Yeah, you've written about that and talked about that. I think that's an underreported part of the story. Because I do think that all provinces have different economic dynamics. And if you see your role as a federal government just to forget about provinces and forget about different economies, let's just go right to the people and make sure they're supported financially. And then you let economies kind of weaken because they don't have the right policies or support from government. I think that's a problem. I think that's a real issue. I've always appreciated the fact that you have, you know, whether you're in New Brunswick or Manitoba or British Columbia, you have fundamentally different economic structures. And when you have a very strong federal government, then their policies should reflect that.
So there is a really interesting poll out in Alberta where they're trying to figure out how do they recover their economy. So the current conservative government is basically pitching doubling down on oil and gas. But then the counter side to it is there's a lot of Albertans that want to say the oil economy is done. We need to diversify away and we should be using government supports to do it. If that sounds familiar, just let me know for the region. The interesting part was when CBC did a poll, they asked about who supported which of those two directions, oil and gas and specializing, diversifying with public supports. They asked two dimensions that I don't normally see. Well, one we normally see, which is, are you tend to vote to the left of the spectrum or do you tend to identify as on the right? And so you get the usual thing that people who identified on the right were more about oil and gas. People who identified on the left wanted more government, more diversification. But the piece that came in next that aligned almost identically with the political allegiance was, what region do you identify with? So if you identified as a Canadian living in Alberta, you tended to side with diversification and public supports. And if you supported oil and gas, you reported as being an Albertan living in Canada. And so if you start to think about some of the changes that go on with internal migration, you start to get people who don't view themselves as tied to a province. They sort of have what they would call Canadian values. And now you have a federal government that can set policy knowing that there's a base in a lot of provinces that would be supportive of a greening of the economy and not doing pipelines and things like that. And you can start to picture where some of the frustration comes in, let's say from the longtime citizens of a province that say, this isn't what we're good at. This isn't our future going ahead. But basically, the federal government now has an ability to speak to Canadians living in provinces as opposed to speaking to provinces. And it's going to cut the premiers out of the discussion at a certain point if we carry on this way.
I think it's, I understand the theory, the way you describe it. I think it in practice, it's going to be problematic. If you look at the tax filer data, I think it's 7 of the top 10 urban centers in Canada for share of the population with 150,000 or more in annual income reported to CRA. 7 of the 10 are in Alberta, and they're all oil or oil related. Calgary is not, nobody's drilling in Calgary, but it's related to oil. Fort McMurray is the highest by a wide margin. There's like 3 times as many people earning that in Fort McMurray than Calgary. So I don't think it's as simple as just saying we're going to pull them off and get, you know, if there's no other job for them, we'll give them CERB. You know, it's one thing to say, you know, here's $2,000 a month. It's another thing to say, you know, you're earning $20,000 a month in the oil and gas sector.
So, David, you'll appreciate this. The group that is most vocal about the diversification strategy is coming from the IT startup crowd, particularly when the Notley government brought in big subsidies for video game companies to locate in there. And so what you have is the top income earners aren't relevant to a lot of this. That's sort of the middle class, again, is the frustrated group that moved to Alberta. They like the city. They like the place. They don't like oil and gas. And there's a story coming out of the West now that young Albertans are checking out because they also don't like the oily legacy that the province holds. So what you're getting going into this next election in Alberta is telling stories about what the future of the economy is going to be, which is the good and noble one, and which is sort of the one we should be ashamed of. And I've also written some work lately on just how Canadian attitudes towards the resource sector have gone and how it's tied up in a lot with what you would call national pride that, or a national shame. So we want to be sort of more seen as sophisticated, or we used to refer to it as being sexy in Davos was the goal, by saying we're going to do things other than kill critters, dig rocks up and cut trees down, which is what made us rich historically. And we're still trying to figure out, do we have a future without killing critters, digging up rocks and cutting down trees? In Toronto, they say yes. In the rest of the country, I think there's a little more debate, but we're
I've talked about this, talked about it last week. I still don't understand why we don't have a more nuanced view there. We have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. We can say, let's get off oil and gas. But if you demonize something as the pathway, right? So this is the way we're going to get off oil and gas. We're just going to spend an enormous amount of effort making it, demonizing it. And then don't you just lead to more polarity in the public? As opposed to, look, we know we're going to need oil and gas for a certain period of time. Let's figure what that period of time is. And let's work toward a solution here over 20 or 30 or 40 or whatever period of years makes sense. And we talked about this last week. But I do think the the caveat with Alberta is the dirtiness of the oil, right? And I know there's a furious campaign to suggest that the oil sands are not as bad as people say they are. But if it gets into that kind of argument, right, clean oil versus dirty oil, you know, where does Alberta come down? Because that isn't the bulk of the growth in Alberta in the oil sands.
It's almost all oil sands at this point, because the conventional oil is, they're doing secondary recovery. But we forget that the oil sands was the federal government and Alberta government's diversification strategy of the 1960s and 70s. And so what would be ironic for the guys who are doing all that back then is they were developing it so that we would have a prosperous future. And now they'd be watching the same interest trying to rip down something that billions of public dollars have gone into developing. So that's a case, again, where values of Canadians change over time. And also, at that point, you have to worry about, do we understand the decision we're making? I want to go back, though, to a point you're making, which is you're doing what we would call a reasonable thing, which is calling for balance. And that's what most people who come from, let's say, the empirical evidence-based side want to do, is let's put the facts on the table and make an informed decision that sort of balances interests on both sides. We're living in a world right now where that's seen as a way of making sure that nothing ever changes, because compromise is seen as benefiting the status quo. And so advocacy-based movements, which tend to want to shift the way the world is operating, want the polarization. And so you get these all or nothing rhetorics coming in, that there is no compromise that's acceptable. And so again, when we go back to how we started on the episode today, which is talking about how people make decisions, if you're trying to think about how you force change, it's by letting people know that you can't be unwavering from your goal. You can't delay getting moving to it. And you sort of paint it as a failure if you don't manage to do that. And advocacy groups on both sides are doing that. If you look at the attempt to paint who's funding who, what's their ultimate motive coming behind this, you see that, again, it's sort of a communication strategy with the public, which is, who should they believe? Do we have a climate crisis or a climate emergency or not? And so this is where, if you said something like the science isn't settled, which is a factually true statement just by the nature of science, it's also not the politically correct one, because the science not being settled is interpreted as you're denying that there's an issue, which is a shorthand, but the fact is most people agree there's a climate crisis and action needs to be taken. Things have been greening, but maybe not at the rate people want. And so now what we get into this problem is, how do we find a balance in a polarized world, which is, that's the strategy for effecting change. And I'd encourage everyone to go read the LEAP Manifesto online, just so that you can understand better how this is working. It's been a very effective political movement that doesn't even require being elected.
So we talk about authoritarianism on the right. I would say that what you're talking about is the potential could lead to a significant authoritarianism on the left. And I'm not an expert in political science in any way. But if you're saying that people don't want to negotiate or work their way through problems and come to an agreed upon solution, the political system that makes the most sense is authoritarianism or even totalitarianism. Because a supreme leader can come in and say, we will do this on the green front, we will eliminate this, we will do that. And there's no need for sort of the democratic to and fro. And I wonder, and I've always thought that maybe young people are a little less committed to democracy, maybe, than older generations, because we're getting a little removed from the period of time when we had totalitarian states. But I don't know. I mean, this is a podcast about economic development in the Maritimes, but I do worry that what you're describing could lead to very polarized politics and authoritarian politics. Because what I say to the young people is, well, yes, if you want an authoritarian to come in and impose a green agenda and impose an environmental set of standards, then if you're in a democracy, the other guy or gal might come in and go in the exact opposite direction. So you're better off, no matter how messy democracy is, you're better off trying to come to some sort of consensus solution, even if it takes a little longer to get where you need to go. But I don't know. I mean, it's just out there. It kind of bothers me.
Well, I think it's worrying. And we still have to remember, you have to be elected at the end of the day. So enough people have to agree with you to carry the seats. But I do think there's a concern over the polarized rhetoric or the polarized attitudes in a legislature. initially in the pandemic lockdown, everyone was excited because it seemed like parties were cooperating. The closer we head towards an election, what we're seeing now is, again, polarization on both sides. Who's claiming who's doing what? Who's going to control the agenda? Who's rigging the election? Seems to be a suggestion here today in the news, which is all just straight out of Trump stuff in the U.S. We have a prime minister who's on his fifth major ethics and boneheaded move. No one seems to care. So there's a situation where he was going to give out $1 billion sole source contract, and his only defense was, I didn't know about it. And the civil service made me do it. But we have to ask, why is that not deadly for him politically, whereas other leaders in the past, it might have ended their careers?
I think you have to get caught with your hand in the cookie jar. So if there was a check written to him, and don't forget about the brown paper envelopes given to Brian Mulroney full of thousands of dollars, although apparently he got those after he was out of politics. But yeah, I think that's the issue. I think any politician that was shown to actually get a direct benefit, but if your mother gets the benefit of your brother, maybe it's seen as a little indirect. I'm not sure.
Well, that's a different meritocracy than I thought we had. So I'd love to see the true definition of nepotism that we now have functionally. But again, it's like, I don't know what the prime minister actually did. I don't know who's in the wrong, but we're seeing this theater playing out with the MPs. My main complaint about all this stuff is we're heading into a fall that's going to be deadly for business. We're more worried about this WE organization that was just going to cut checks to people who didn't want to work because they weren't getting the jobs that they wanted. So the frustration with a lot of these things is that the politics and polarity will sidetrack us with issues that aren't helpful when you think about the big problems that could be coming, or just doing positive steps to growing the economy. And it's like having kids fighting in the back seat. You're trying to drive a car. Let's say you're the business sector and you just got these kids brawling in the back seat and you have to keep pulling over to pull them apart. And then they promise to be good again. You start driving and they're at it again. Right. I don't know how you develop an economy when that's sort of the model that we've allowed to develop.
So one of my goals is to keep you optimistic, Herb. So I'm just going to read from to finish off your column. I'm going to read from the last paragraph of the column. It says, I now judge that the changes we need to make to improve our chances of avoiding an economic crisis in New Brunswick will not happen. And I now understand why my approach of presenting data and information to inform public discussion and maybe even decisions is likely a complete waste of time. Now, I've had days when I've thought what I do for a living is a complete waste of time. I like to think that overall, you know, I'm contributing to the discussion about economic development and how you grow an economy. I think, you know, you guys like you and I have had positive influence on, say, the rate of immigration. I think if we hadn't had strong voices making the link between immigration and economy over the past 5 years or more, I don't think we'd see it. We'd see it kind of reactively, right? Businesses screaming even more and more, and then you'd get a few more immigrants. But I think because some of us have been making this argument, so I'd like to think there's been a few wins, and I'd like to think that you've had a very positive influence, although I agree with you. We haven't, you know, there hasn't been light bulbs going off over politicians' heads, and certainly not over the general public. But I would like to suggest to you that if the result of that column is you're not going to continue this fight, I think that's a big mistake, Herb. And I think you should continue the fight. I think you are making a positive impact. You know, just the fact that you're actually annoying some people on the left of the spectrum is actually a good thing. It means you're actually getting through. So I'm going to ask you right now to continue to commit to fighting this fight over at least for until you retire in like 15 years or 20 years.
So it's an interesting reaction I've had to that line, because if you really take seriously the message of the whole column, that statistics, information don't matter, but the story or how you give the message does. It's kind of like if you've ever been in a room where someone who's influential just says, I'm done, I'm not doing this anymore. They stand up and walk out. The whole room stops and wonders, what have we missed? And it gets attention. So sending a message like, this is hopeless, you guys are going over the cliff, I'll see you on the other side. There was one comment online in the in the TJ that I quite liked, which agreed with me that it was a waste of time and just to go on vacation till people came to their senses in the crisis. So that would be sort of one reaction. But the other one to remember is there's a great quote in that Undoing project about, I think it comes from Tversky, which is, it's far easier to work to make the world a better place than to prove that you made the world a better place. So when you think about how you spend your time, you can go around trying to educate and convince people, or you can just start doing work quietly and sort of help groups that are making positive change and put your efforts that way. So it really comes down to, who's your audience? Is this really helping anyone? And is there anything else you could do with your time if you really want to affect better decisions? Now, if you want a conspiracy theory to get the everyone worried about this, I'm going underground. I'm just going to talk silently to people. You won't know who I'm talking to, and I'll be as shadowy as the other figures. It's been interesting being more out in the public because you take lots of hits from people who don't like what you say. But when you operate as long as you and I have in these circles, where I tend to be out in the open and try to be transparent about who I'm working with and what I'm doing, you and I both know there's a large mass of people who are never seen that are very influential, and they have good ideas and sometimes not so good ideas, but they've learned through a lot of, and often it's lobbyists, that they just know there's more effective ways to reach decision makers directly. And they're not writing columns in the Telegraph Journal. And so in a sense, the louder I am, the least influential I am. So if I go quiet, the people who don't like what I'm writing should be more worried. So this should get everyone on side to keep me writing.
So, yeah. So I think you're tilling the soil, and then you do want another layer that's actually working on the people that make decisions. So this should be a multi-level strategy. But now I understand what you were doing. So you actually pulled a Tversky on us, although it's more, instead of a nudge, it was more of a shove.
Yeah.
The nudge is supposed to sort of just gently get people to change their mind, but you actually pushed people in front of the car or something.
Yeah. It's just, if you really think through what gets attention, it's making a decision or taking an action that people notice. They don't know why you're doing it. So I just sort of leave in a huff, and then people take the huff as sort of as somehow a sense of how important the information must be. That's the Kahneman Tversky part. Is that they don't key on anything said. They key on, let's say, the strength of the decision.
Yeah. So I've been married 26 years, and a few times over that period, my wife has said, "That's it. I'm done. It's over." Well, maybe she hasn't said it's over, but but certainly when there's a pronunciation or pronouncement of that scale, you know, it does really get your attention. So I appreciate that. So you actually are not moving away from the debate and the discussion. You're just sort of, you're trying to get our attention.
The challenge is, how do you do a more effective way of reaching your audience? And, you know, you and I both participate in the Turning Point series, and that was a big issue, I think, for how do you get to a broader audience? How do you have the discussion? We felt we were looking for compromise, and in a few cases, the feedback I was receiving is they viewed us as the establishment pushing an agenda. So how do we change that conversation? How do we engage more people? So I don't plan on just quitting. There's days where you throw your hands up and you say enough, but I'm too stupid to do that. I always seem to wander back onto the playing field.
That's because it's fun. Because even if you get a few little wins, it makes sense. Listen, before we switch to a new segment that I think is going to be exciting for us this morning, I wanted to ask you a little bit about this mobility thing. And you sort of talked a little bit about it earlier. I want to push back a little bit about that, or maybe just get your thoughts, because, you know, ever since I've been in New Brunswick, you know, active in economic development over 20 years, everybody talks about this going down the road, right? There was a movie in the 1970s about Maritimers who just said, "That's enough." They packed up their big Chrysler and they moved to Ontario, where that was the land of milk and honey, or Alberta or BC, whatever the province of growth was at the time. And I think we have to have a little bit of a more nuanced view of that. So I'll give you an example. My best friend from high school is now the mayor of Fort McMurray, or with Buffalo, or whatever it's called out there. He actually went out there in the, let's say, the mid to late 90s, and set up a very successful law practice with 20 lawyers, and he went on to be an MLA, and then now he's mayor, and he's just killing it out there. Now, you could argue that he had far more success in Alberta, in Fort McMurray, than he would have had in New Brunswick. And so that's a that's an argument that says, well, if you really want to be successful in New Brunswick, you just leave. If you know, and that's sort of the message that a lot of people are telegraphing to young people. And I want to push back a bit, is because what I would argue is, isn't that the case in general? If you're sitting in Winnipeg, or you're sitting in Brandon, or you're sitting in Regina, or you're sitting in St. John's, or Grand Falls, or Charlottetown, and you have decided that all of Canada is your labor market, aren't you just fundamentally better off on average than if you decide, no, Charlottetown, I'm staying here, I'm not leaving? Because I think that's part of the what I'm trying to ask you is doesn't that apply no matter where you are in Canada? I don't know if I'm being clear about that, but you know, yeah. New Brunswick is a small province with small urban centers, with rural communities. Isn't it just natural that there should be quite a bit of mobility because there's just not going to be enough jobs that meet people's specific interests, whether they want to be a biologist or a brain surgeon or a professional athlete in small urban areas? So isn't the issue more that people that view their career in terms of a national or even international labor market, aren't they just naturally going to be better off than those that make a calculated decision to stay in a small community?
So your observation is correct that if you think about population dynamics anywhere else, small cities are emptying out to the larger places. You've got, if you're going to make it in Ontario, you're going to Toronto is the argument. And you hang around there till your dream job comes up, because I've younger brother and sister who won't leave Toronto, in part because, you know, if you leave Toronto, you're out of the game and you won't get back in. So there's a tendency to want to go to the larger centers. But the part that makes it unique in the Maritimes is people care about you leaving. When I left London, Ontario, no one cared. It's just another one's leaving, but we'll get 10 more to replace them. And in a lot of cases, if you left, you were treated as the loser because you had to go out west to make a go of it. You couldn't make a go of it here. So you spend a lot of time when you live in Western Canada trying to get back to the home province to prove that you're important. And you saw this dynamic through the big companies with the head offices in Toronto. You're dispatched to manage a branch in the hinterland. And if you do a good job, they call you at some date back to the big city. And you sort of keep a cottage there, but you sort of deny you really had anything to do with it. So the interesting part here is because there's no return migration for people wanting to come in to replace the people who have left, you start to see a feeling more of regret because it's more of a hollowing out dynamic than you would say have in Ontario, where if I go to London, Ontario, where I grew up, I know some people who are still there, but the population turnover feels like it's been 100% since I left, and the city's larger than when I left. It doesn't have the same industrial base anymore. It's university, hospitals, more government. But again, what you see is when you can get other people to come in, no one cares if you go. Even if you're the superstar, they don't care if you leave.
Okay. So, and I actually, my daughter goes to Western, so I've had a chance to go to London several times, and it seems like a landlocked Halifax. It seems like a pretty interesting place. But 10 of the last 12 years, we've had more people move in than out to New Brunswick, and that's including immigration. So it does, I want to push back against this view that it's all outward and not inward, right?
Yeah.
So if you have, as long as you have more people moving in than out, and as long as you have enough of a churn to support your economic goals, why does it matter? So I guess that's the thing. I think you're right. You've hit on a point. If you leave Nigawack, you know, it's a huge tragedy. If you leave London, they're like, don't let the door hit you in the arse on the way out or whatever. And I'm not sure if that's true, but you're from there, so you would have better knowledge of that. But at the end of the day, I do think there is that sort of sensitivity, is why is anybody leaving my community? And it's the same, why would anybody want to move to Nigawack, or why would anybody want to move to Fredericton, or why in the world would you ever want to move to Moncton? Well, I've moved to Moncton. It's a pretty friggin' nice place to live, as far as I can tell. Is it the best place in the world to live? Who knows? I mean, that I'll let somebody else decide that. So I guess the question then, Herb, is why does it matter? As long as you've got, you know, people moving in, why should we be concerned about, or overly concerned about, people moving out?
So the reason I think we're concerned about moving out is we know that the out migrants from anywhere tend to be younger, and they also tend to be more educated. And in return, when we looked at in-migrants to New Brunswick, and even I would guess the Atlantic region, what you tend to see is instead you're getting higher age groups, so let's say middle-aged and older. And so they're not balancing the loss of your labor market entrance the same way. They will be higher educated, but they're also not moving to your cities to the same degree. They're moving more into rural areas and doing things. So maybe it's semi-retirement to retirement. When we look at who moves to Alberta to work and who commutes, it tends to be if you were in the middle age groups, you lived in New Brunswick and worked out west, whereas if you were younger, you just moved out west. And so in a lot of cases, the churn that we're worried about is in Ontario, if someone young leaves, another young person will move in to fill in, or an immigrant will come in and take the place. So you're not losing the same human capital and human potential with the out-migration the same way you are in the Maritimes, where we don't see the labor market bringing in competitive young people to compete for the jobs that are here. And I also think we're seeing a bit of tax arbitrage around retirement ages, that once you drop down to a pension income, you're not in that high top bracket anymore for tax. So if the penalty of living in the Maritimes isn't as high as if you're, say, 40 years old, headed towards the peak of your earnings years. Let's say you're lucky enough to make $200,000 a year, which is in the top 1% in Canada. Would you choose to do that in New Brunswick, or would you choose to do that in Ontario or Alberta?
Yeah, obviously, because of the marginal tax rates, unless there's some other overwhelming reason, you'd want to do that in Alberta, no doubt. But I do think the landscape is changing, and we'll get a chance to talk to you about this more. You know, because sometimes I think part of the problem is we do live 10 or 15 or 20 years behind in terms of our understanding of the data. So I went in just yesterday, and 48% of everybody in Toronto between the ages of 25 and 34 reported less than $35,000 in their 2017 tax returns, okay, and tax filer data. So that's almost half of everybody in that age cohort, and that's post-university for the most part, 25 to 34. And that was the same ratio as in Fredericton. So 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I would suspect, and I have looked at some of this data over time, there'd be far more people in Fredericton at that lower income level adjusted for inflation. So I think there's just a lot of service industry jobs, no matter where you are. And I think for whatever reason now, this sort of, and the other thing I posted on my blog is that the average couple income in that age cohort, 25 to 34, is only 4% different between New Brunswick and the rest of the country. So yes, you earn a little less here, but you don't earn dramatically less, again, looking at newer age cohorts like 25 to 34. So I just think the thing is changing. And I think this sort of rosy view that if you leave, you're better off, I think that applies anywhere, whether you're in Brandon or whether you're in Moncton or even in Toronto. The stat I love to point out is that Toronto has a negative intra-provincial migration rate in an average year.
So you're completely right. The difference is no one in central Canada, Manitoba, Alberta, Saskatchewan cares if you leave if you're young. They don't. There's a complacency that comes with, we'll just get more young people.
Yeah, and that's a historical artifact. Yeah.
Okay, so the question I think we really need to know more about is, what is it that discourages young people from making a go of it here? So why won't they stick it out? And one thing that we do know that we've studied is that for prime age earners who are in jobs, their unemployment rate is extremely, extremely low, which tells us that the opportunities to compete to get into the labor market here aren't as good as other places with, let's call it, more unemployment and more risk. So again, if I sit around here and nothing's happening, I go to Toronto, something might happen. Is that the logic that we're dealing with?
Even though 50% of kids aged 25 to 34, let's say young adults, earn less than $35,000 a year in Toronto. So I'm not sure it's as rosy a picture in Toronto. Now, in absolute terms, you have more opportunities, but you also have millions of people fighting for those same jobs.
This is the psychology part. So where do you think your chances are best? If you believe that you're really good, you want to go to a place where you can compete and move up. And if you live in a larger place, like even the pain of moving to a smaller place that's not as active. So when I announced I was leaving Alberta, a main reaction from a lot of people seemed to be, oh, he doesn't have it anymore. He's just given up. And it wasn't that way in my mind at all. But there's sort of a cachet that if you move to the hot market, you must be good. If you're a reverse migrant, and this is a cultural thing that I think Marshall Button has written about, the Boston Dickies are the failed migrants who came back to New Brunswick pretending they had an accent after a few weeks away. And so you're not very kind to people who come back historically, because again, the going down the road guys, if they couldn't cut it, came home. And yeah.
I mean, so I think there's nuance. I think you're absolutely right. If you're very ambitious and you're prepared to driver, you know, obviously you have more opportunity in a large center. But that whole argument about being a big fish in a small pond or a small fish in a big pond, I think there's still some merit to that. And I think increasingly, you know, young people that find niche opportunities in places like New Brunswick, whether it's entrepreneurship or whether it's a career opportunity, a job, you know, I think these dynamics are changing. I do think in the 70s, it was considerably different than it is today when it comes to that dynamic. Okay, we're going to end today with a new segment. It's a quiz. So it's a little unfair because you're relatively new to New Brunswick. But on the other hand, you study the province just about like, I don't know if there's anybody else that crunches the data like you do and your team. And so I've got a series of questions about basically demography, in some cases the economy here in the province, and I'm going to ask you to pick the municipality that meets the criteria that I'm going to tell you. And if this goes well, I ask people to play at home, and if people like this segment, we'll do it again, because there's all kinds of dynamics we can use from the census. So we've just got a few here today. So I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to give you four communities. You're going to tell me which one you think best answers the question. And then we'll see if this is kind of a fun little segment. Okay. So in terms of the groundwork, for most of these, we're talking about communities with at least 2,000 population. So if I fall below that threshold, I'll let you know. But basically, there's over 200 communities in the province. So I wanted to sort of limit it to give you a little bit better chance of success. All right, the first question. Which municipality in New Brunswick has the most men relative to women? So across the province, it's almost even, right? 100 women, 100 men. I think it's 98, 102, but nevertheless, it's almost even. But there are some communities where there's quite a spread. Which do you think has far more men or relatively more men than women? And the choices are A, Sussex, B, Blackville, so in the Miramichi, C, Oromocto, just outside Fredericton, or D, Moncton. Which one do you think has the most men relative to women?
I'm going to go with Oromocto.
So you are correct. There's 120 men for every 100 women. And why would that be? I suspect it's because of the military, right? There's still more men than women in the military, but I don't know if you have any other thoughts as to why Oromocto would be so high.
Well, again, it would be my instinct was the military base. It's had in-migration as well for the region, which tends to make you younger. You tend to find more feminine populations and aging populations because they live longer. So if you had given me a list of old places, it would have been tricky because I'm trying to figure out who's not quite as old. Moncton is going to be a challenge to evaluate in general because, again, I'm going to interpret any question you ask me about Moncton as Moncton, the CMA, Census Metropolitan Area, not the city itself. But
yeah, it's the city itself. So that's the weakness here. But so explain Blackville then. So there's 118 men for every 100 women in Blackville, which is about as rural and old as you can get in the province. So is that just an anomaly, or is there something about something in the water, maybe that because there's so many fishermen that it's more men than women? There's 118 men for every 100 women in Blackville of all places.
Well, again, so the only way to really get there is you either have to have a lot of widowers or you have to have a lot of young guys. So one of the peculiar features of New Brunswick demography is that up until age 18, there's more boys than girls in the population. And then without migration, you tend to lose more males than females. And so it flips. You start to have more women per men. So with Blackville, it may simply be they got a large number of kids that are somehow influencing this, or you have a commuting range into what would it be, Miramichi from there?
Yeah. Yeah.
The short answer is I don't know.
Okay. So which municipality has the most women relative to men? And so before the men run out and move to the specific municipality, they have to be careful because these could be older women. Based on what you just said, women tend to live longer. So we have to be careful. You have to look at the age before you make the move. But which community in the province has the most women relative to men? Your choices are Carriquet in northeastern New Brunswick, Miramichi, Fredericton, or Sussex in south central New Brunswick.
I'm going to try and create some excitement in the south and go with Sussex.
You are correct. You know this province better than maybe I thought you did. Yes, 120 women for every 100 men in Sussex. Now, again, before you run out and move to Sussex, if you're a single male, just make sure you check the age demographic out there because I'm not sure. Okay, next question. Which municipality, again, not urban area, but which municipality in the province has the most mobile homes? We talk about Trailer Park Boys and Trailer Park Girls. Which municipality, and by the way, this is by a wide margin, so I don't know if that's a little hint or not, but this is a wide margin. So is it Lincoln, just outside of Fredericton? Is it Sussex Corner, a sister community to Sussex? Is it Hanwell, the rural community just outside the periphery of Fredericton? Or is it Bathurst, the city in northern New Brunswick?
I'm going with Lincoln.
You are correct again. You're gonna win the prize here. 41%. I lived in Lincoln, and there are a number of large trailer parks, but at the time of the 2016 census, 41% of all dwellings in Lincoln, so that's down the Nevers Road, that's lower Lincoln, that's much of upper Lincoln as well. 41% of all occupied private dwellings in Lincoln are mobile homes. So the good news is if you have to run, you've got an easier way to get out of Dodge pretty quickly. Interestingly enough, Sussex Corner is actually quite high, 23%. That's the next highest. Hanwell, 14% is quite high relative to the average across the province. So it looks like that periphery around Fredericton has a lot more mobile dwellings, I guess, if people want to hit the road. Bathurst, only 1%, very few mobile homes in Bathurst.
Just an observation, if we're worried about regional governance and tax reform, the fact that you get these kinds of donuts with that type of housing circling a community as opposed to integrated in it tells you that there's probably some distortion going on that could be addressed with regional governance and better coordination on tax structures.
Yeah, we'll have that conversation another day, but there is, depending on what urban area you're in, the periphery versus the core, the economics and the population dynamics can be significant. Fredericton is a perfect example of that. Okay, which community in New Brunswick is the oldest as measured by median age? And this, again, is from the 2016 census, and again, based on communities with just 200 or 2,000 or more population, because there's some very tiny ones that are older. Your choices are Minto, outside of Fredericton, Dalhousie, a fairly well-known community because of losing its mill a few years ago, Carriquet in northeastern New Brunswick, or Edmundston in northwestern New Brunswick. And again, this is by a fairly wide margin, and it's only communities with 2,000 and up. But which of those four is the oldest in the province?
Wow, if this is like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, can I call a friend? Or is there any life? I'm going to go on a limb and say Minnow.
So this is your first fail, and I would have thought
no,
because of your work, I thought you would have known it's Dalhousie by a wide margin.
So Dalhousie, I wasn't sure because First Nations tend to have younger populations, so I don't know if because we know there's a lot more First Nations representation in the north. So
yeah, maybe not in that village, but there's so Dalhousie, 58.4 was the median age at the time of the census. Minto was 52.7, Carriquet 50.5, and Edmundston 51.3. So that's a pretty old community at 58.4. I will say that I've done a lot of work in Ontario, and there are a number of smaller communities, retirement communities in Ontario that have a similar age. Okay, so the flip side of that, which community in New Brunswick is the youngest as measured by median age? And again, if you missed this one, I would be very surprised for a very specific dynamic.
Oh, but which is
which is the community, right? If you fail this one, we'll have to end the quiz here. The choices are Fredericton, Dieppe in the Greater Moncton area, Rothsay outside of St. John, or Oromocto? Which one is the youngest by a wide margin, by a 8 or 9 year margin?
No, I'm going to get this wrong for sure. I would either go Oromocto or Dieppe, and I'm going to go on a limb and say Dieppe.
Oh, it's a fail. Oh, geez, you should have phoned a friend. It's Oromocto because of the military, I assume, because of the military base. 30.2 is the median age. Dieppe is pretty young. It's 39.1, the median age in Dieppe, but Oromocto by a wide margin, and it's got to be the influence of the base, which takes up such a large part population in the Oromocto area. Okay, the next one. Which community in New Brunswick is the most bilingual? Specifically, which one has the largest share of the population that claim knowledge of both English and French? So in the census, you're asked, do you speak French or English? This is what we mean by bilingual. We didn't go out and actually test everybody in the province. So is it A, Memramcook, B, Bactouche, C, Grand Manan, or D, Woodstock? Which is the most bilingual community in the province?
I'm going to go with Bactouche.
So you're very close, very close. Memramcook, 81.2% of the population claims knowledge of both French and English. Bactouche is just close, 80.5. Grand Manan is not there. It's 3.9. It's actually one of the least bilingual places in the province. And Woodstock at 10.7 is fairly bilingual for that part of the province. So you're very, very close, sir, but you're on a losing streak here. Let's see if we can get you a win. All right, for people who work full year and full time, so they work year round, not seasonal, which community has the highest median employment income? So this is again, if you have to be working full time and full year, is it Quispamsis, New Maryland, St. Stephen, or Grand Falls, Grand Sault? Which has the highest median employment income for full time, full year workers?
I've heard people talk about New Maryland being that hidden gem, so I'm going to go with New Maryland.
Oh, geez, Herb, you got to brush up on your trivia. Quispamsis, of all places, 66,634 was the median full-time income for full-time, full-year workers at the time of the census. Very close. New Maryland was 65,000. St. Stephen was 43,000, and Grand Falls was 44,000. So Quispam and New Maryland are right there at the top. That was almost a trick question. I apologize for that. All right. Which community relies the most on government transfers? So if you look at as a share of total income in the community, which community relies the most on government transfers, which includes CPP, old age pension, employment insurance, workers' compensation, and other direct transfers from government to individuals? Is it Packetville in northwestern New Brunswick? Is it Shippigan in northwestern New Brunswick? Is it Minto just outside of Fredericton? Or is it St. Andrews? Which community relies the most on government transfers as a share of total income?
Oh, man. If EI is included in there, I have to go with the north. So I'm going to hopefully not offend anyone and say Shippigan.
Very close, but it's actually Packetville. 37.1% of all income. So nearly $2 out of every $5 in that community comes from government. Shippigan is 32%, just behind them. Minto at 30, and St. Andrews is only at 15.7. So St. Andrews is the outlier there. Which community relies the least on government transfers? Is it Hanwell, the rural community just outside of Fredericton? Is it Rothsay, the rich community outside of St. John? Is it Riverview outside of Moncton? Or is it Salisbury, the little hamlet about 15 minutes outside of Moncton? Which one relies the least? And I'll give you a little hint. This does not include government payroll. This just includes government transfer income. Hanwell, Rossay, Riverview, or Salisbury?
So do local government transfers to local government from the province count in that?
No, this is personal income. This is the amount of government money directly shipped to individuals.
My instinct is to go with Rothsay, so I'll go with that one. But Riverview was my toss-up.
You didn't take my hint. I said it doesn't include government payroll. It's Hanwell, 8.2%. 8.2%, just outside of Fredericton. Rossay, very close, 8.5%. Salisbury was 18.5. So that was the outlier there. Which community has the highest share of households with at least 200,000 in annual income? And again, as you indicated earlier, that's not a large share in general, but there are a few communities where, and there's one community that's an outlier. I'll tell you that right now. Which community has the highest share of households with at least 200K in annual income from the census? Is it Grand Bay, Westfield, Oromocto, Dieppe, or Rosse?
Dieppe.
Rosse, 12%. 12% of all households earned 200K or more. Dieppe is 6, Oromocto is 2, and Grand Bay, Westfield is 5. So, Herb, I apologize. You were on a roll the first three questions. You've slipped since, so you're going to have to brush up. A few more questions, and then we'll be done. Which community has the highest share of immigrants in the population? Is it the city of St. John, the city of Fredericton, the parish of St. George, or Woodstock?
Fredericton.
Fredericton is correct. 11% at the time of the census were the population was not born in Canada. St. John, it was 6%. In St. George, it was 5%. And in Woodstock, it was actually 8%. Woodstock is the highest among the secondary communities in the province for the share of immigrants in the population. Okay, just a few more. Which community has the highest share of owner households spending at least 30% of income on shelter? So this is a prime measure of cost of living. Which community is the worst on that front? In other words, they spend the highest share of their income on housing. Is that St. Stephen, Rishabucto, Camelton, or Fredericton?
Fredericton.
So very close, but it's actually St. Stephen. 28% of all households in St. Stephen spend at least 30% of income, because Fredericton has a higher cost of housing, considerably higher cost of housing, but also higher incomes. So as a share in Fredericton, it's actually 24%. So one out of every four households actually spends 30% or more. In St. Stephen, it's 28. Rishabucto, it's 26. And Camelton, it's 23. So it does relies partly on the cost of housing, but also as much on the actual average household income in the community. So which community has the lowest share of communities making I'm going to skip over that one because I didn't actually answer it myself. Okay, which community has the highest share of the population age 25 to 64 with an earned doctorate? So which is the smartest community in the province as measured by earned doctorate? That does not include medical doctors. I apologize, but it does not in the context of the census, and it does not include other kinds of honorary. It's earned doctorate, so basically PhDs. Which community is it? Sackville, Quispam, Sis, Kings Clear, or Fredericton? And this is as a share of the population. I will tell you right out of the gate, Fredericton in absolute terms has by far the most earned doctorates. But as a share of the population, Sackville, Quispam, Kings Clear, or Fredericton?
I would go with Sackville.
It is correct. 5% of everybody living in Sackville has an earned doctorate, compared to 2% in Fredericton. Although, as I say, Fredericton has 700 at the time of the census earned doctorates. The next closest community was Moncton at 280. So Fredericton is killing it in terms of smart people, and maybe that's why that community drives her nuts. Okay, which community has the highest share of self-employed in the workforce? Drummond, Cocan, Caraquet, or Burton? And this is a minimum workforce of 1,000. It's not population. It's a minimum workforce of 1,000. Drummond, which is northwest of Fredericton, Cocan, Caraquet, or Burton, which is the highest level of self-employed people?
Oh, man. So this could be contractors in the woods and things like that? Yeah,
definitely. Yep. Agriculture, anybody that's self-employed.
So short answer is I don't have a clue, so I'm going to go with Burton, just to say Burton.
So Burton actually has one of the lowest rates of self-employment in the province at 4%. It's Drummond. Huh. And I think a lot to do with the woods because there's a huge forestry sector up there. So that's a good one. Two more questions. One, which community has the highest share of people commuting at least 60 minutes a day, which is a weird thing in New Brunswick because not very many people have a commute of 60 minutes or more, but there are a few communities where the number is higher, considerably higher than average. Is it Alnwick, which is it's the parish surrounding Nigawack. Is it Kingston, which is just outside of St. John? Is it Tracadie in the northeast, or is it Memramcook in the southeast? Which community has the highest share? And the highest share is only 14%, but 14% of everybody that commutes to work every day has at least a 60-minute commute. Is it Alnwick?
Is that one way?
One way, yeah.
So how far is Memrun Cook from Moncton?
It's like 20 minutes, 25 minutes.
So it can't be them because they don't live far enough from the major center. What were the other three again? You had Alnwick.
Alnwick, yeah, just outside of Niggawack, Kingston, and Tracadie. So two of them are in the northeast. So Tracadie, it's close, but no, it's Alnwick. I don't even know how to pronounce it, but yeah, 14% of everybody living in that community spends at least 60 minutes. So I don't know if they're commuting maybe Miramichi or beyond, maybe even as far as Moncton, I'm not sure, but that's the community. Finally, and if we like this segment, we can do it again, maybe with some more realistic questions, but which community has attracted the most population from elsewhere in Canada between 2011 and 2006? So that's called interprovincial migration. And we're doing it again as a share of the population. So which community has attracted the most population from elsewhere in Canada? Is it Oromocto, St. Andrews, Sackville, or Dalhousie? So as a share of the population, and this one is the winning communities attract. So it's a bit of an unfair question maybe, but the winning communities attracted four times as much as their nearest competitor.
I'll go with Oromocto.
Yeah, you are correct. Oromocto, 32% of everybody living, everybody over the age of five living in Oromocto in 2016 did not live in Oromocto in 2011. So I don't know if the military brought in a whole new cohort or what, but 2,540 people lived in Oromocto that did not live there in 2011. St. Andrews, 8%, Sackville, 9%, and Dalhousie, 8%. So those were other communities. So that was good. You did about half. You got about half right, Herb. Next time we'll maybe look at more economic as opposed to demographic characteristics. But I do appreciate you. You're a good sport, and you win a Jupia Consultants or Growing Pains T-shirt.
You guys are supposed to get coffee mugs made up.
That's a good idea. So I'm going to get coffee mugs. If we do this again, the winners can get a coffee mug. We'll actually maybe open it up to the public. Yeah.
Sounds good.
Herb, this has been great. I appreciate you joining us today. We will have you on frequently if you'll come back
anytime.
I appreciate that. Matt George will be back next week. He's a married man, so let's see if that changes his demeanor. And we do appreciate you listening today. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.
The Growing Pains podcast is produced by the great Zachary Peltier and is part of the Unsettled Media Podcast Network.